This is Wade's World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me on the east side of town?
This is Wade Rafkin. You're listening to Wade's World, a Voice of the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points north and south, east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at www.kabf.org and www.acornradio.org. A podcast will be available to the show on these websites and www.affiliatedmediamovement.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. And today we're talking to Rebecca Burns, who's a Chicago-based investigative reporter, contributing editor, and pretty much writer that we follow closely for End Times. Welcome to Wade's World, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me, Wade.
A pleasure. You recently, we've been in touch over the last year, year and a half, but recently you wrote a very interesting article about the movements rekindling and pretty much picking up around the country around rent control. What's happening around rent control?
That's right. Well, rent control has kind of been off the table politically in states where it doesn't already exist for the last few decades. And the reason for that is that realtors were very successful starting in the 70s and through to the 90s in passing something called preemption laws, so essentially saying that cities couldn't pass their own rent control laws. And there's been kind of a concerted push in a couple states across the country to overturn those laws and sort of say, you know, in the context of this housing crisis, which is continuing to deepen, we want to put the possibility of rent control back on the table.
And rent control has been has existed in New York City and some other markets for quite a long time. Why does it continue to be so controversial?
Right. You know, it's faced pretty much constant opposition from, you know, the real estate lobby, essentially, you know, plain and simple. It's a set of regulations that constrains their profits by saying, you know, these are the circumstances under which you can raise rents or how much you can raise rents by. So the real estate lobby has consistently opposed it and put a lot of force behind that opposition. It's also something that's, you know, really hated by sort of neoclassical economists who have put out a lot of research sort of claiming that it leads to decreased quality or quantity in the housing supply. And, you know, more broadly, in the various periods where there have been sort of militant tenant unions pushing for rent control, they've been the subject of a lot of red baiting. There's been a lot of conservative politicians who have tried to say, you know, this is nothing more than the demand of sort of fringe communists. Everyone else knows that regulating the market and housing will actually lead to worse outcomes for tenants.
We should all get buttons now because the way rents are going up around the country and eviction rates are rising, we should all get buttons that say, I'm a fringe communist too. that might be a separate campaign we can get involved in. Now, we've seen this kind of preemption struggle and living wage bills. Tens of states, probably a majority now, have passed. With conservative legislatures have passed preemption things to not allow cities to be able to do living wage ordinances. It goes on and on. But I read in your article it's now more than 35 states that have these blockage legislation to stop rent control in individual cities?
Yeah, it's almost 30. And those, you know, as you said, we've sort of paid a lot of attention in recent years to preemption laws that have to do with things like living wage laws, fracking. But the rent control preemption laws, I think, have really until recently flown under the radar, even though, you know, it was one of the early causes of the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is sort of the shadowy conservative group that has kind of really pushed preemption as a strategy. A lot of its early members were real estate interests and made this, you know, a key effort in their push to kind of, you know, constrain progressive possibilities at the local level by passing these very restrictive state laws. And they've been very successful with regard to rent control. And it's, again, only recently that local housing rights activists have kind of said, okay, we have to go to the state legislator and overturn these, or else, you know, we're never going to get anywhere with trying to pass rent regulations at the local level.
And of course, Alec, as you referred to it, has been, you know, well publicized as a favorite of the Koch brothers and others, but it's hard to beat the level of power at the local level that real estate interest and major developers have. And so it's probably shouldn't be a surprise that there's so much preemption. But one of the things that your piece in these Times highlighted was some new efforts, particularly in Illinois, Washington, and California, that are trying to do something about rent control. What's happening out in Washington?
That's right. So Washington, as of this year, has a Democratic majority in the state legislature, and that led to a push by various tenants' rights organizations who got a Democratic sponsor and tried to put forward, you know, what would have been, I believe, the first bill to actually overturn one of these state preemption laws around rent control. Now, that bill was introduced in January, and it's since died in committee, but I think, you know, it won't be the last of those efforts. There's still a lot of energy around that, and it's sort of interesting to see that, you know, having a Democratic majority in the legislature didn't necessarily help. This is not necessarily something that Democrats, you know, especially if they get a lot of donations from the real estate industry, necessarily support. So Illinois still has an active campaign to overturn the state-level rent control preemption. It's called the Lift the Ban campaign. That bill is picking up sponsors slowly. Again, it's something that it's very difficult to get you know, even sort of mainstream Democrats on board with. There are going to be subject matter hearings across the state, most likely this summer, to kind of, you know, give tenants and tenants' rights groups and, you know, local activists. The Democratic Socialists of America have also been involved in this effort locally, give them a chance to kind of flex their muscles and have tenants testify about how the housing crisis is affecting them.
Well, in a lot of these cases, certainly Washington Community Action Network is one of the groups that you highlighted. They're not going to go away. But where we've seen some real progress, and I was just in California last week, is with groups like ACE, the former California Acorn, and others have been trying to do a statewide initiative out there. Have you followed that issue?
Yes, I have. You know, it's especially interesting because California, a lot of cities, you know, have rent control. California was sort of one of the epicenters of tenants' rights movements that, you know, passed the first wave of rent control legislation. But since the 70s, they've seen sort of nonstop attacks by real estate lobbies to kind of chip around the edges of rent control protections. So California now has the Costa-Hawkins law, which sort of really both prohibits rent regulations around newer units and a number of other restrictions that housing advocates say just really kind of kneecaps the effectiveness of rent control. So groups like ACE, as you said, and others put their weight behind a bill that would repeal Costa-Hawkins and allow cities to pass sort of more robust rent regulations. That bill has stalled, but they actually went back and successfully collected enough signatures to put this question of repealing Costa-Hawkins on the bill this November. So voters will have the chance to decide, you know, do we want to give cities the chance to really reckon with this crisis of rising rents?
And in some ways, and we're talking to Rebecca Burns, who is an investigative reporter and a contributing editor at In These Times, who's followed some of the crisis in rent and evictions and predatory land problems over the recent years. Some of this is Sacramento is also an interesting situation where they have been trying to extend rent control, I think, to single-family homes. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah. So one of the other things that Costa-Hawkins does is it exempts single-family homes from rent regulations. And, you know, you might think that that wouldn't necessarily be that impactful. And a few years ago, or, you know, a decade ago, it might not have been as significant in kind of, again, weakening rent regulations, except for the fact that private single-family landlords such as the Blackstone Group, which is a New York-based private equity fund that kind of in the wake of the foreclosure crisis has scooped up hundreds of thousands of foreclosed single-family homes and turned them into sort of pricey rentals. So Invitation Homes, reportedly, according to an investigation in local media, is now the largest private landlord in Sacramento County, and I think it's the largest land property owner, second only to the county itself. So they control a huge share of the housing market, and they're exempted from rent regulations. So in these single-family homes that increasingly people are renting out when they've lost the homes that they own to foreclosure or they can't find another place to live, you know, they can jack the rent essentially as much as they want to in those single-family homes. So that's a place where, you know, were Costa-Hawkins repealed, I think local the local government would really come under pressure to pass a much more robust form of rent regulation.
Now, and I don't know. I know they were trying to organizations were coming together to try to get a separate local initiative on the ballot in Sacramento. Talking to organizers out there over the last week or two, it looked like that was a harder climb for on the Doors. I mean, there's a lot of confusion around the issue, and I guess Blackstone and its allies have been pushing back that this could really change things in a way that would be negative. So they were having, I'm not sure if they got the signatures or not to file. I mean, we'll have to watch that more closely. You haven't heard, have you, Rebecca?
No, you know, I've been following that, and it's really interesting. It'll be really interesting to see what these private equity landlords, these Wall Street landlords, you know, what role they play in the fight to kind of preserve the existing legal regime that sort of weakens rent control. You know, are they going to throw their considerable resources into the fight against stronger rent regulations? So I'm not sure of the status of the effort in Sacramento, but definitely following, you know, whether we see this kind of new class of Wall Street landlords step into the fray here.
If I were a betting man, and I'm not, I would bet heavily that we can count on them coming in with both barrels. I also met with Davin Cardenas, who's one of the lead organizers in North Bay organizing project. They'd had a very important rent control fight. They lost narrowly about a year ago, but after the fires in Sonoma County and around Santa Rosa, they're trying to put it back on the ballot over the next couple of weeks. One of the things that was interesting talking to Cardenas is the way the homeless issue is breaking on rent control is problematic. They're campaigning in Santa Rosa that rent control won't solve homelessness. Well, seems like an apples and oranges. Why is that coming in? It turns out a lot of support they'd gotten before was the notion that homelessness has really been rising throughout California cities. And I think one of the campaign tools has been to say, okay, we need to expand affordable housing. This will stop it. So opponents are really hammering them about, and Davin was telling me, even liberals are picking up this. Well, I'm not sure rent control will stop homelessness. So, I mean, it's how these things all get combined and that sort of strange concoction is going to be a problem for us, isn't it?
Right. I mean, you know, rent control won't stop homelessness. That's true. I think
yeah, gotta admit
people who are
that.
Advocating it. Right. People who are advocating it, you know, I think are also saying we also need much more far-reaching solutions. You know, we need to stop the privatization of public housing. We need to reinvest in public housing. You know, we need economic redress for communities of color that were redlined and then flooded with predatory loans. So to sort of, you know, say we shouldn't support rent control because it won't stop homelessness is sort of, you know, a logical fallacy. It's one tool that I think anyone would say is like the first step and what seems achievable for the first time in a long time right now, but certainly a lot of people are working on also pushing much longer term solutions.
This is obviously a national crisis, though. I know your article detailed this. I mean, the amount of money people are spending as part of their income and the lack of construction. Why is this not a bigger national issue?
Yeah, you know, Matthew Desmond, author of Evicted, who's been doing a lot of reporting on this, you know, one of the headlines that his research grabbed recently is that, you know, evictions have been a crisis for renters on the level that foreclosures were for homeowners, you know, during the years immediately following the housing crash. But it's been you know, it's been constant. The magnitude of evictions is so much greater, but I think we sort of prioritize homeowners in the national dialogue around this. And also evictions are also, you know, really, it's a much more invisible crisis. We don't keep, you know, good national data on evictions. That's one of the things that, that Desmond's organization, Eviction Lab, is gathering data on right now. And, you know, people who are going through eviction are often ashamed. You know, they're kind of just going to stay with friends or family, in some cases ending up homeless. So we're not seeing, you know, we haven't yet seen, although I think we're starting to see renters organize themselves in the same way that we were seeing in some cases, you know, homeowners who are facing foreclosure were sort of getting organized and being taken more seriously as a political constituency in the wake of the housing market crash.
Even Desmond's project, though, with the Eviction Lab at Princeton, understates pretty seriously the level and crisis of eviction. I mean, there's so many people, as you know, who leave before they have formal papers filed. Leave because of disputes with the landlord, leave because of, you know, verbal increases in rents, all of which has the same impact of evictions, but don't show up in the data line in the way that
right.
You'd want as powerfully. So it almost, in reading Desmond's stuff, it almost looked like we were undercounting that the level is. I know the Federal Reserve did a study, for example, when you talk about Blackstone in Atlanta, 22.2% is the eviction rate in corporate-owned housing in Atlanta. Double what you find in Detroit, for example. So what you're talking about in terms of Blackstone and Sacramento, where that was a big issue with Invitation Homes, that's also another one of those things that's not front page news, but it's a real problem, isn't it, Rebecca?
Yes. So, you know, that Federal Reserve study that you're citing, you're absolutely right. The really disproportionate rate at which they're filing against eviction against their tenants. And, you know, just as you said, the rate of eviction filings is you know, one of the best methods we have of finding out how many people were evicted, but it certainly doesn't capture, you know, how many people got a notice that their rent was, you know, increasing by 40% and just decided to give up and move out, or, you know, found that the company wasn't going to fix their roof and they didn't have the money to, and eventually, you know, the stress of it caused them to just cut ties and move out. So we don't have a lot of great data yet on what, you know, on what effect having these big Wall Street landlords own significant swaths of the housing in communities like Atlanta, Sacramento, to some degree in Chicago. We don't have a lot of data yet exactly on how much of an effect it's having, you know, at what rate they're evicting people market-wide, how much they're raising rents. But anecdotally, you know, it's not looking good. Certainly if you know, Blackstone owns half of the houses on a given block, because they tend to buy very heavily in very concentrated areas, they really wield a lot of power in that housing market and have the ability to really, you know, squeeze a lot of blood from a stone as far as, you know, tenants who are already suffering, usually in areas that were hard hit by foreclosure.
We're talking to Rebecca Burns, who's an investigative reporter. She's been following the housing scene and has written some excellent pieces in these times, where she's a contributing editor. You know, even Desmond's book, Evicted, you know, in his sort of street-level survey, he was coming up with effective de facto eviction rates that were more like a third of all tenants in low-income mm-hmm. areas. Based on these informal things, which would double or triple some of the rates he was reporting to the eviction lab. So, yeah, we're not going to get statistics at the federal level, but I know at the street level, door knocking on the Acorn Home Savers campaign, we're finding a huge percentage of the people that end up in predatory installment land contracts are coming because of eviction problems and coming because they can't afford rent, so they're willing to sign contracts they don't understand that are as-is contracts where sometimes the conditions are not very good. Are you picking that up in the Chicago area as well, or in your reporting?
Definitely. You know, I think that that's what makes a lot of this new wave of Wall Street, you know, financial products and housing products viable, is that people are desperate and out of options in a lot of cases. Either as you said, because they've already been evicted, or, you know, they already had a predatory loan that they were foreclosed on and their credit is wrecked and they can't afford rent. And so they're, you know, looking to turn to one of these contract for deed agreements just because they don't have any other options. So yeah, I mean, I think it's really a case where the situation has been set up ideally for an especially predatory class of landlords and lenders to kind of come in and take advantage of people all over again, who in a lot of cases, you know, already went through a previous wave of housing displacement.
This may not be a fair question, but is there anything you're working on now, Rebecca, that you could give us any insight on and that affects this kind of issue?
Sure. I mean, I'm continuing to follow this issue of contract for deeds in Chicago and in Illinois. You know, we did pass some legislation that had some good measures requiring certain disclosures in the contract for deed registration. So I'm definitely looking to see how that kind of affects the landscape. And I think, you know, generally I'm interested in gathering as many of the stories as I can that you're talking about, Wade, to show that you know, the crisis is much deeper than really shows up in the statistics we have available, just because of, again, the array of different ways that people are going through housing displacement, and especially through this new wave of landlords and lenders who are, you know, hedge funds, private equity funds, out-of-state investment companies that are in some ways kind of playing by a different set of rules.
Or playing by no rules at all. I mean, contract for deeds obviously came under the jurisdiction of the Dodd-Frank Act, which is being diluted, but I haven't seen whether or not they're trying to eliminate the restrictions, the supervision of the Consumer Finance Protection Board or any of the Dodd-Frank provisions on contract for deeds. Have you?
You know, I haven't seen them get around to that piece yet. It certainly
we should
seems
probably
like
not talk
given
about it, Rebecca. You know, we don't want to put a bean up their nose. But
right, yeah. I mean, there are plenty of products that have already been, you know, what regulations there are have been weakened, or what regulations were reportedly in the works have kind of been scuttled. So yeah, I think it's likely to get worse before it gets better, certainly.
Well, one problem in that whole area of installment land contracts is that so many of these new sort of tools, scams, whatever you want to call them, that aren't, you know, by definition contract for deeds, still have the same impact. I mean, we ran into, on the doors in Memphis a couple of months ago, we ran into a woman who'd signed a agreement. Wasn't a contract for deed, but it was a land installment contract, and she was pretty satisfied with the payments, three children, $700 a month, et cetera, et cetera. We asked her what the term of the contract she had was. You're not going to believe this. 57 years.
Mm. Oh, my goodness.
She was 27 years old. And,
wow.
You know, and, you know, maybe it was 53 years, but, I mean, it was like whatever it was, she'd be lucky to live. If she stayed in that place, she'd be lucky to live long enough to satisfy the agreement, and God knows what she would have paid. I mean, it's just crazy, some of these things. So there's a lot of, you know, button, who's got the button, where these real estate and hedge funds and others may not be formally. And that'll be interesting to see on your work in Illinois, whether or not this new act, which was very encouraging, I know, had a lot of support from many activists and housing rights groups in Illinois, whether or not it sort of spreads the net far enough to catch some of these scams. That'll be an issue.
Yes, I think it definitely will.
But in Illinois, maybe they'll even amend it and improve it, which is not what we can say in many of the places that are listening to this show.
That's right. I think there's hope that, you know, and it'll give people more space to organize and hopefully educate people around, you know, how to stay clear of these. But as we've discussed, you know, in order for that to work, there needs to be better options for people who otherwise don't have good housing options.
Some people may not be familiar with In These Times, so we're coming near the end of the show. Could you give people a sense of the magazine? I know it's been all around a long time. I'm certainly a subscriber, but some people may not know about it. Why don't you give us some sense?
Sure. Well, thank you for subscribing. We are a progressive national magazine. We're based in Chicago. Started in 1976 and headquartered in Chicago, kind of especially to cover, you know, developments in the labor movement here in one of its first places. And we sort of give special attention to movements for social, economic, racial justice, environmental justice, covering campaigns like rent control, you know, in an ongoing way. We're available online at inthesetimes.com. We're also a monthly print magazine that folks can subscribe to.
And, you know, old-timers like we subscribe under not just under my name, but under Butler Rathke. So it's, one of the few family subscriptions we both put in for. But it also, there's a very good feature they're doing now, In These Working Times, is that what it's called? I know I get it on email, but it...
Yeah, Working in These Times is our labor blog. You know, and since the inception of the magazine, we've been dedicated to covering workers' rights and the union movement. And that includes both union workers and, you know, workers in the informal economy, non-union workers, the organizing they're doing. So you can get that for free online. Just, again, off the main website, inthesetimes.com.
This program is produced by the Arkansas Broadcasting Foundation, KABF-FM in Little Rock, Arkansas, and is distributed through Affiliated Media Foundation Movement, AMFM, serving the needs and interests of low and moderate income Americans.